Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than boasts.
Welcome to Bookmark. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And there's a historical theme to this week's show. Our featured guest is Lucy Bland, talking about her book, Britain's Brown Babies, the stories of children born to black GIs and white women in the Second World War. We also hear from Peter Manler discussing the increase in mass education since the Second World War. And Giles Brandreth regales us with stories from his book, The Oxford Book of Theatrical Anecdotes. But first of all, Lucy, welcome to Bookmark. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But as I say, historical theme to the show, history, was that always going to be your area of study?
Well, funnily enough, it wasn't actually, because I had a really bad history teacher at school. And it so matters. Teachers are crucial, aren't they? So she made it so boring, and it was just about dates and kings and queens, that I didn't do history as an undergraduate. I didn't even do it at A-level, I'm ashamed to say, because it was so taught so drearily. But I went on, I did my PhD in history, and I sort of got into it ever since, really. I suddenly realised this is absolutely wonderful. But, you know, I have been interested in history, but it was just the way it was taught really put me off. I think things have changed today, hopefully.
Well, you're a teacher of history, so that experience has presumably informed how you teach.
Well, yes, because I think it's very important to make it engaging, but relevant for contemporary issues as well, because of course it is, and exciting. And I'm very enthusiastic, so I think that certainly comes over to my students.
And social and cultural history, what does that mean? Is that away from the idea of monarchs, as you were mentioning, and battles?
Exactly. It's how people lived, how they expressed themselves, how they represented themselves. So it would include writers, etc., but also just everyday life and what's called popular culture, the magazines of the period or whatever. So it's a wide remit of material, but it's certainly focusing on the experience of people.
And you focus particularly on gender, sexuality and feminism. Why are those areas of particular interest to you?
I got into feminism quite young, I think, when I was about 20. And it was somehow so revealing to me at the time. I mean, this is in the 70s, when I really hadn't thought about these issues, that suddenly everything made sense. And I thought, for goodness sake, why have I not known about this before? I mean, now it's part of culture. You know, no one doesn't know about feminism in some kind of way, and it means different things to different people, but nevertheless everyone knows about it. But you know, then it was still relatively new, and I just found it incredibly exciting. So that's what I wanted to work on.
And it's, I suppose, relatively modern history that you study, is it?
Yes, late 19th century through 20th century. I've been going forward. So my first book, based on my PhD, was about the period 1885 to the First World War. And it was about how women, feminists in particular, were involved in debates and campaigns around sexuality and sexual morality. And then I moved forwards, and then I wrote a book about women in the 1920s and court trials. This third one is really up to date with live subjects. It's the first time I've actually worked with live subjects, which is quite different and a huge responsibility, because you have to, you know, obviously make sure that they're happy with what you write. I did show everything I'd written to them, written about them, to get their approval. Whereas, of course, if people are dead, you haven't got the same responsibility.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you about this book, but let's listen to your first choice of music now, which is, well, it's Take the A-Train by Duke Ellington. But before you tell me why you chose that, is music important to you?
It's very important to me, yeah. Some people work with music playing. I find that too much of a distraction, but I love music, and I've had music all my life.
And this Duke Ellington track, why this one in particular?
Okay, so the three tracks I've chosen, they're all by African Americans, because this book I'm talking about is about the relations between African Americans and white British women. And this one, Take the A-Train, it was written in 1939. It was written for Duke Ellington by Billy Strayhorn. And Take the A-Train, what it comes from is Duke Ellington telling Billy Strayhorn the instructions of how to get to him in Harlem. And he says, you know, take the A-Train, which of course is a subway in New York City. It's a wonderful song. My father adored Duke Ellington. So it's got lots of personal as well as, you know, historically relevant implications.
That was Take the A-Train by Duke Ellington, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Lucy Bland. Lucy is Professor of Social and Cultural History at Anglia Ruskin University. Her research, as we've heard, has concentrated on the history of gender, sexuality and feminism in Britain from the 1880s to the 1980s. She was a co-editor of Women's History and is now on the editorial board of Women's History Review. Her book, Britain's Brown Babies, recounts the little-known history of the 2,000 or so babies born to black GIs and white women during the Second World War. It's a fascinating book, Lucy, and obviously we're going to talk about the content in some depth. But just for a moment, I wanted to address the title, Brown Babies, rather than Black Babies, when black is, I guess, how a lot of the American GIs would describe themselves. Why did you choose that title?
The term sounds a bit terrible, but it was the term given at the time by the African-American press to these babies. So in Britain, the term was half-castes, which was used, you know, very widely right up until the 1980s, at least. But the African-American press were very interested in these children, and they actually campaigned to try and get them out to the States. And they coined this term, the brown babies. So I felt this was an appropriate term to use. It's of the period, but I put it in inverted commas because, of course, some people think, oh, goodness, this sounds a terrible term. But, you know, it is of its time. And in fact, many of the people I've interviewed subsequently have thought, OK, we are the brown babies, and feel quite happy with that term.
Why this research? What was it about this subject that first attracted your attention and drew you to it?
I never heard of these children until I was watching the second of a three-part series called Mixed Britannia. It's about the 20th century and about mixed race people in Britain through the 20th century. And the first part took us up to the beginning of the war. And the second one opens with George Alagaya, who was the presenter, going off to meet his brother-in-law. And the brother-in-law, Tony Martin, was one of these children born to a black GI and a white British woman. And he'd been put in Dr. Bernardo's, and he was subsequently very happily fostered. And then later on in the programme, there's another, Brian Lawrenson, who was in children's homes in Liverpool, and he talks about his experience. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. So these two are mentioned, but no others. And, you know, I didn't know how extensively this has been researched. So at the time, I was working on the 1920s, but I thought I will go back to look into this and see if anyone else has been working on this, if there's been much been written. If not, I'd really like to investigate further. So 2 years later, 2013, I went back and found that actually very little had been written about these children. And so I just started to try and find people. And then people just got in touch with me. It's amazing. I mean, through things like GI Trace, which is an online organization that helps people find their GI relatives. Also being on the radio, I was on a lot of local radio. Then I was on Woman's Hour. That led to a large number of people contacting me saying, I'm one of those, or my mother's one of those, or whatever. And it was incredible. So I didn't have to go and look too much. I just have to say I was doing this work and people came to me. And what's been brilliant is since the book came out last year, I've had more people come. And I think, although it's the official figure is about 2,000, I think there were more of these children. I mean, no one knows. There were obviously quite a lot. So I just thought it was really interesting because it's history that's not known generally. I mean, a lot of work's been done on the Second World War, but very rarely are these children mentioned. It's also something of interest to me because I come from a family which has a lot of mixed raceness, if you can use that term, in it. My father's second wife was from Guyana. I have a black stepsister. My nephew has children, mixed race children. He was an Indian wife. My partner and I adopted a baby from Guatemala when she was tiny. She's now 20. So these issues about race and mixing have been around in my own life for a long time. So the coming together of my own personal interests and the fact that this is a history that's barely been known and really ought to be known seemed a very good reason to go further.
And in most, if not all of the cases, the black GI, the father of the child, went back to America.
Not in the case of one of the ones that I interviewed who'd been born in the 50s, because although I was looking at the war predominantly, a number of the people approached me, born to black GIs in the 1950s. And I first of all thought, oh, well, that's interesting, but this isn't the story. And then I thought, actually, why don't I talk to them and see what's changed, has much changed. Cynthia was the only one whose father had actually married, and she was born in the 50s, and he stayed over here. All the rest went back to the States. I mean, they were made to go back to the States. They had no choice, and it was hard to get back. I mean, many of them weren't very well off, and they weren't being offered ships to come back. Many were married, and in fact, many of the women were also married. So there were all those other complications. So even had some wanted to come back, it was very difficult. And some did keep, you know, kept in touch, but it just became, I think, impossible. So sometimes the grandmother, the mother's mother, would intervene and destroy letters. I've heard stories of that, because she was saying, look, this has got no future. And these children were illegitimate, as I mentioned earlier, because the American military wouldn't allow the black GIs to marry. All GIs had to get permission from their commanding officers to marry. They were invariably white, the commanding officers. They would refuse. The reason they gave was that 30 of what were then 48 states had laws that forbade marriage between whites and blacks. And 75% of these GIs came from the South, where they certainly had these laws. And there was a case of one woman who went back in 47 and married her black former GI, and he was in prison and she was deported. I mean, you know, it was just very, very difficult.
Lots of the GIs didn't know that they'd left behind a pregnant woman.
And that's true. I mean, white and black wouldn't have known. I think, you know, with the white GIs, sometimes I imagine some of the women, if they were already married, could have passed off a white GI baby as the husband's. And the mother of one of the people I interviewed, she was married. Her husband was away. She tried to do that initially with Babs. It worked to begin with, because Babs was, to begin with, quite pale. But by 6 months, her skin had darkened and she was sent off to Dr. Bernardo's. I mean, presumably the dates had roughly fitted when they'd come back. But there were quite a lot who went back and simply didn't know that they'd left babies behind. And what's so tragic is that some that did know and tried to contact the children that had been put in children's homes, some of them were absolutely rebuffed. What's incredible is when some have found their fathers eventually, or found at least their relatives, they've discovered that the fathers did know about them and always hoped they would find them. They simply didn't have the means to go and find them themselves. They didn't have the finances or didn't know how to go about it.
And for the women, the options were really to either keep the child, relinquish the child to a children's home, or fostering. And they were under a lot of pressure to relinquish the child rather than keep the child.
If they were a single woman, the stigma of illegitimacy was enormous in that time. I think it's quite hard for us to appreciate that today. And to have a mixed race child, that was an additional stigma. And they might have a lot of opposition from her family, from the local priest, the mother and baby homes, the social workers. I mean, there were all sorts of pressures put on her to give the child up. And it was also very difficult to find childcare if she wanted to keep the child. For instance, her mother or father might say, you're not having child at home. Where is she going to live? And then how is she going to get childcare? And a lot of childminders would say, I'm not having that child. I mean, extraordinary stories. And even nurseries wouldn't have those children. And so some of these women, even though they wanted to keep their children, felt, oh, well, they'll have a better life. They'll be adopted if we give the child up. But what's so tragic is actually very few were adopted. They were put in children's homes. And although there was a big demand to adopt, there wasn't the same demand for black or mixed race children, or rather there wasn't thought to be the demand. I mean, it's interesting because the adoption societies before 1948, they were private societies, and they explicitly said no one would want these children. And what is actually very shocking is some of these children were fostered, but the fosterers were sometimes encouraged to foster these children because they got more money, because they were supposedly hard to place. A few that I talked to were fostered, not always successfully, sometimes only for a very short time. Tony Martin is one of the few who was very happily fostered. I mentioned earlier he was George Allagher's brother-in-law.
Can you measure outcomes? I mean, now we would try wherever possible to keep a child with a birth relative as opposed to placing a child for long-term fostering or adoption, because believe the outcomes are better for children who stay with family to whom they're biologically related. Can you measure outcomes in this sense for this group of children? Did those who stayed with their birth mothers thrive more than those who didn't?
I think it depended hugely on whether the rest of the family were supportive. So I think some who were kept by birth mothers who had very supportive grandparents didn't do too badly at all, or lived in a neighbourhood where they were accepted. Some sort of little villages, just to say where people work. They tended to be in the areas where the Black GIs have been sighted. So all over East Anglia, because the Black GIs had come to build the air bases, the 70 air bases, along the south coast and southwest, some in the Midlands, some around Lancashire. So there were often little villages where people knew everybody and they might be accepted there and feel very supported. But on the other hand, in certain other areas, even Liverpool, various parts of Liverpool, where they got a lot of abuse, and the mothers did as well. I mean, the mothers were shouted at and hit, and I mean, just extraordinary. So it really varies about the location, the family background. Well, I think being put in a children's home and spending your whole childhood in a children's home was very difficult. And the people I've talked to who underwent that, some of them have subsequently found it very difficult to have families of their own because they've never known what it was to be in a family. And one person I talked to talked about how he's developed relationships even with people who've already had children and who are calling him daddy and whatever, but he found it too difficult, too claustrophobic. He can't do it. You know, and if you've been brought up without that, to suddenly get into that, it's just impossible for some. So I think your experience as a child are so important to how you live subsequently. And it can be very damaging.
Thank you, Lucy. We'll come back to you in just a moment. But we'll stay with the Second World War or use that as the starting point to talk to Peter Mandler about his book. Peter is a historian of modern Britain who teaches at Cambridge University. The Crisis of the Meritocracy, Britain's Transition to Mass Education Since the Second World War, was published in September. It examines the reasons for the increase in the number of people enjoying further education and the effects of this rise in numbers on society and the economy. But when I spoke to Peter, I started by asking him why this particular issue interested him.
I'm the kind of historian who jumps around from subject to subject, so this was not predetermined by any means. The practical answer is that I got involved 20 years ago in debates within the historical profession, both at university and at school level, about the nature of the history curriculum and who should be studying history and when should be studying history and why. And as a result, I decided to try to align those kind of professional concerns with my research agenda. And I started asking bigger questions about the growth of education. It's an obvious historical phenomenon. It's so obvious, it's all around us, we hardly notice it. In just one or two generations, we've gone from a world where very few people get education beyond primary level to a world where everyone does. And so I just wanted to explore that. And on the political agenda now, it's a big issue as to how much education we should provide and to whom and who's going to pay for it. And I've become more and more involved in education policy. I'm president of the Royal Historical Society for 4 years, and I'm now president of the Historical Association, which is the School Teachers Association. So for me, this is just everyday business as well as interesting question.
And that growth, I hadn't realised it was so enormous. So pre-World War II, only 2% of the population had any sort of serious education. And today, 50% go to university. I suppose we associate that with Tony Blair, but you're saying that started further back under Margaret Thatcher.
It started even further back. The fact is there's been a continuous upward trajectory in participation. When governments set targets, they sound like they're just pulling these figures out of the air, but they know full well that these targets are the place where the trajectory is going to reach soon. Kenneth Baker set a target of 30% in the late 80s, and then 20 years later, Tony Blair set a target of 50%, and 20 years later, it was achieved. I mean, it's a no-brainer, really.
But you're arguing that these results, this change is about more than a political drive.
That's right. I mean, I don't mean that the politicians have no impact, and they obviously do in little ways, but I think in the big picture, they're basically just responding to forces beyond their control. And in every country in the world, and especially in the more affluent countries, the years of education have been extending and levels of education have been extending. And there's a whole range of reasons why people want and demand more education, and politicians give it to them.
And I suppose with the increasingly complex and changing world, with modern technologies coming in, the demand for education to support us in all aspects of that is increasing.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's interesting that you reach for technology, which is, I think, what we always do. Again, it's something that politicians reach for because they like to argue that every reform has an advantage for economic growth. But the point about the growth of education in the last 100 years is that, it's growth of complexity in every aspect of life, not particularly to do with the workplace. There's something called the Flynn effect, which a social scientist named James Flynn identified, in which he shows that IQ rises in most modern countries over the course of the last century. He thinks it's because in every aspect of everyday life, we encounter more and more complex, abstract problems. We're more mobile, so we have to be more flexible and agile and be able to respond to the unexpected and unforeseen. We can't rely on tradition, what our parents told us. It's just life gets more complex, and so our IQ rises because we just cope with those problems. But we need education really to help us to deal with those demands.
And an increase in the availability of it, does that necessarily mean a downgrade, if you like, in the quality of it?
One school of thought worries a lot about that. I mean, as I say, it's a universal feature. It's necessary just to cope with modern life. And so at a basic level, no, it's what we need to live in the 21st century. You know, you may be concerned that if more people are gaining access to the more elite levels of education, that they're not really up to it and it's beyond their capacities. And the worry is that that might be diluting the quality. But that would be a very niche problem, I would say. I mean, I don't know how to put this politely, but I've taught at low-ranking universities, in fact, the lowest-ranking university in the country at the time. And I've taught at high-ranking universities, in fact, the highest-ranking university in the country at the time. I haven't noticed that my very brightest students are any different or any less well-equipped or any less brilliant and talented than they were 20 years ago. And actually, you know, I was at university now almost 50 years ago. If there may be a sort of stretching out and dilution simply because more people are having to be accommodated and there's more different subjects to accommodate as well, if there is that, and I'm not saying that there is, it's been compensated for by the seriousness that people apply themselves to education.
And do you think that perspective is quite healthy? Because certainly when I was growing up, somebody with a university degree was a rare and hallowed being. And as we know now, half of students end up at university.
I wouldn't want to presume to guess your age, but until the late 80s, the proportion was kind of stuck at about 14% of all 18 and 19 year olds who went into any form of higher education. And it's now, as you say, 50%. So just in that span of time, in the last 30 years, there's been this enormous change. Similarly, 70 years ago, around the time of the Second World War, hardly anyone went to secondary school. I mean, forget about it, higher education. Hardly anyone went to secondary school, only about 20% of the population. And then all of a sudden, everyone went. These are huge changes. And it means that, of course, that education has changed. We teach a much wider range of students. We teach a much wider array of subjects. And people are headed off in all sorts of different directions. You know, they're not only just going into the professions or teaching. They're going into offices and shops and all sorts of jobs. And that all the indicators are that that's good for those people, not just intellectually and in terms of their jobs, but just in terms of their health and their tolerance of difference and their flexibility and trainability. You get a huge array of advantages from education.
And what's the future? Where do you see it going? Where do you see this trajectory going?
It's very hard for an historian to answer a question like that because, you know, we study the past. And as the investment advisors say, past performance is no guarantee of future returns. There have been these upward trajectories, but can it go on forever? No. On the other hand, we've reached the 50% target just last year. Meanwhile, South Korea is at about 70%. And the Higher Education Policy Institute have been calling for universal higher education. You could say that's maybe their job to do that, but I mean, they have good reasons to argue for that. So I don't think it's impossible that my grandchildren will live in a world where everyone stays on to 21, just as it seemed impossible 50, 70 years ago that everyone would stay on to 18.
And how does the UK compare to your home country, America?
Well, you know, it's only my home country technically, and in terms of what you can hear in my accent, because I've lived here most of my life. I mean, America, of course, was ahead of the curve. It was offering much more higher education much earlier than any country in the world. It was already at about 30% participation in the 50s. One of the problems it's encountered recently is that even more than in this country, America has been politically driven by lowering taxes. And so there isn't as much public support, I mean, tax support, financial support for higher education. And that has caused a bit of a crisis. People still want higher education in America, but they have to pay for it themselves. And so they rack up these whopping great debts that they have to pay immediately after they leave higher education. I mean, I know people are worried about the debts that we now impose upon university students, but they don't have to pay them until they're earning above the median income, whereas an American student has to pay them immediately. They have to pay much more until they're paid off. So that debt burden is really beginning to crush the desire of people to have higher education in America.
And the crisis of the meritocracy, Britain's transition to mass education since the Second World War by Peter Mandler, is published by OUP Oxford. We're talking on Bookmark today to Lucy Bland about her book, Brown Babies, the history of the 2,000 or so babies born to black GIs and white women during the Second World War. The minority of the people you questioned went to children's homes, but I think, is it true of the majority that they weren't told about their parentage?
Yes, the majority really didn't know about their fathers. I mean, it's extraordinary to think about this, that the mothers would sometimes simply lie. They would say things like, oh, your father's dead. I can't remember his name. Some of them didn't even know he was American, let alone black. This thing about realizing that they were black, it was interesting because some of them, you know, they were called names. And they didn't really internalize it. They didn't quite know because they were being brought up by a white mother and might have white half siblings and white grandparents. And then people calling these things, they didn't know what it meant. But then it gradually started to realize they were different. I didn't know why they were different. They might have eventually been told that you had a black father, but often they weren't even told a name. It's really been very difficult for many of them to have lived a life without knowing about their father. They felt this huge void, this great absence in their life. Some did manage to find fathers. The thing is, they came up a lot of obstacles, not only, as I said, the mothers not revealing anything, although one or two were given fathers' names, but they also came up against the US military. For instance, if they had the father's name and where he'd served, they could go to the US military and they'd say, no, we're not giving you anything, it's private. And they'd also said that a lot of those records, and this was true, in 1973 had been burnt. This is in St. Louis. A lot of those records were being retrieved, put back together, but they wouldn't help. Daughter of a white GI, Pamela McLeod, who, with her group, War Babes, she managed to turn the law around. It was brilliant. She worked with some civil rights lawyers in the States. And in 1990, she got a law introduced so that the military had to divulge information. Okay, so that was something. But if you had no name, you couldn't really get very far. So when I interview people in the last 4 years, quite a few of them said, I haven't even got a name. So I said, look, DNA, I mean, this is the way forward. In the States, ancestry DNA in particular is used, and by African Americans, because African Americans often want to find out about their ancestors, what part of Africa they'd come to, and slaves, etc. And some are now finding, not fathers, because the fathers would be well into their 90s, but are finding half-siblings, cousins. I mean, extraordinary. And they are finding that transformative. Others have managed a bit earlier on without DNA. Monica, for instance, in 2002, when she's shown how to use a computer, she eventually got the name of her father or her mother. And her brother then found what was a death certificate, and he died 8 years previously, but she then was able to find out more about him. And
that was a really moving part of the book. That chapter was very moving about the reunions and the finding, and how finding the father, establishing contact with the father or his family, meant they found a part of themselves, that they found part of their identity.
That's right. I mean, I think one's sense of identity is in part predicated on a sense of belonging, and belonging is about what your heritage is. And you may know about your mother's heritage, although if you were in a children's home, you probably didn't even know that either. But their sense of difference was very difficult because they were growing up in very white areas. They had no role models on the whole, and they had no fathers. Or they had a stepfather who some of them initially thought was a father, but then it became clear that he wasn't. So yes, I think having that huge gap in your life can be really quite destroying. And I think those who've now found fathers, or found at least photos of fathers and found relatives, are saying that it's incredible. They actually now have a sense of belonging in a way that they didn't before. I mean, one talked about feeling whole when he found his father.
Thank you, Lucy. Well, let's hear your second choice of music now. This is Ella Fitzgerald and Summertime. Why this one?
Well, Summertime, I think, is a wonderful song written by Gershwin for Porgy and Bess, which, you know, is an all-black opera. And my mother used to sing it to me as a child. I love Ella Fitzgerald, who, you know, certainly was around in the Second World War. I don't think she actually sang it then. I think she sang it a bit later. But her version of it is absolutely fantastic.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
In 1960s Cambridge, you might have shopped at Joshua Taylor, gone roller skating at the Corn Exchange, and seen the Beatles perform live at the Regal Cinema. On Sunday mornings, John Gannon takes you back in time with hits and memories from the swinging decade. John Gannon's 60s scene, Sundays at 8 a.m. on the station that's live and local, Cambridge 105 Radio.
Looking to buy a new home this summer, but it feels out of reach? Then getting on the property ladder just isn't an option for you. Think again. New homes in Haverhill and Cottenham are available now with shared ownership, with your mortgage deposit as low as from £4,000. The final 2 and 3 bedroom homes at Bower Place and Boyton Place also have exclusive incentive packages available worth over £2,500. With £1,000 shopping vouchers, £500 towards your solicitor's fees, and 3 months rent free, book your viewing today to find out what's on offer. Reserve from just £99 and find your new home this summer. Think shared ownership, think Complete Moves. Visit complete-moves.co.uk or call 020 3640 7111 today. Terms and conditions apply.
Need dropping off at work? Missed the bus and must make that urgent appointment? Need picking up after a night out with your mates? Panther Taxis is your Cambridge-based taxi firm with over 700 drivers, offering great rates and local knowledge, ensuring you make it quickly and safely to your destination. We don't inflate our prices at peak times, and all our drivers accept payments by cash or card. Book your taxi the easy way. Download our free Panther Taxis app through your app store and start booking your taxis on the go. Call Cambridge 715 715 or see panthertaxis.co.uk. Panther Taxis, your local, quick, reliable and friendly taxi company in the city.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Rather than books.
And on Bookmark today, we're talking to Lucy Bland about her book, Brown Babies, a history of the 2,000 or so babies born to black GIs and white women during the Second World War. Lucy, one of the tragedies, I thought, of the book was that often the women would relinquish their children, their babies, to children's homes, believing that that was in the best interests of the child. And some of these homes were pretty horrific.
Yes, some of these children's homes were horrific. I mean, interestingly, the nurseries don't sound too bad. I mean, sound really good. So Honeycott House, which was a nursery in Somerset, it was a National Trust building that had been relinquished to Somerset County Council in the war. And they'd first taken it for evacuated children. But in the end, they turned over for children who'd been born to black GIs, because there were a lot of such children, particularly to married women. Nearly half of the mothers were married. This nursery was run by nursery nurses, well, was staffed by nursery nurses, who were very loving. And these children were all in it together. They didn't have parents, but they didn't know what parents were. And they had a very good time. And they were there till they were 5. And then one or two were adopted, and others went on to other children's homes. Hearing about some of the other children's homes, you know, some of these had a lot of quite sadistic people who worked in them. And they were sort of institutionalized. Everything was taken off them. So they had nothing of their own. And it's interesting, the ones that talk about being in the nursery, that sharing everything, they still are in touch, some of those people, they feel that closeness to them. But when they get older, that depersonalizing of any individuality, I think, was very destructive for them.
And again, they were not given information. Information about them was withheld.
They were lied to. So one of my interviewees, Billy, he asked about his parents and they just said, oh, they're dead. They're dead. Or they were told, and other people were told, oh, they're dead, or your mother doesn't want you, which, you know, both of which are horrendous. And then Billy was very enterprising because he was once sent to have a TB injection and he was waiting in the waiting room. He's handed a form which has an address on it, which in fact is his mother's address. He memorises his address and then at Christmas he writes a card, dear sir or madam, so sweet, because he said that's how he'd been told to write these cards, I'm Billy. And then he gets this letter back from his mother. It's lovely, saying, you know, so lovely to hear from you and if you ever want to be in touch. And he did then get in touch with her in his 20s and would see her every year, and she died a couple of years ago in her early 90s. But most of them had no information. What the Children's Centre would say is, you want a clean slate, that's behind them. What they would also do is separate any children that got close. So Billy and someone called David got very close and they got separated and sent to different children's homes. And years later, when David was in his 40s, he eventually found Billy. And he said this was the one person who he'd loved and who'd loved him. I mean, it's just amazing. So that closeness from a really small child, you know, sort of 5 or 6, had stayed with him, and otherwise he'd have these ghastly experiences in children's homes.
There was a move at one stage for the children to go to America to be adopted by American couples.
There were campaigns for this. So the African American press wanted them to come out, and there was a big organization in the States called the Brown Babies Committee of African American couples who were saying, yes, we would like them. Britain blocked this. What happened was that Somerset County Council went and visited the Home Secretary, James Shooter Eade, he was called. He said, no, it wasn't possible. It went against the adoption law. And the adoption law at the time said that a child could only be adopted by a British subject or by a relative. And because there was no DNA then, and the fathers were only putative fathers, it couldn't be adopted. But then there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And for a really short period, in 1948, some of these adoptions were allowed. So one of the people I've interviewed who was adopted by his father in the States got out there right at the beginning of 49. And so, you know, he managed to get through. But then it all was kind of blocked off again. And I think, you see, the government felt very ambivalent because on the one hand, they didn't really want these children because they were obsessed about having a white country. But on the other hand, they had a very complicated relationship to the United States. They didn't want to be seen beholden to the States. And they didn't want to be seen, this is to quote, as dumping these coloured waifs on America. I think they were caught in this dilemma about what to do. And then they felt, no, we should say we're keeping them. But they didn't help in any way at all. They didn't give any help to the mothers to keep the children.
Thank you, Lucy. Oh, well, we'll come back to you shortly. Let's hear our second interview of the show. It's Giles Brandreth. He's a writer, broadcaster, actor, former MP and Lord Commissioner of the Treasury, now Chancellor for the University of Chester. His many books include the Sunday Times bestseller Dancing by the Light of the Moon, about the transformative effects of poetry, a biography of John Gielgud, and his own Westminster Diaries. The Oxford Book of Theatrical Anecdotes came out in October. The Daily Mail described it as, by turns, hilarious, poignant and deliciously scurrilous. Dame Judi Dench, no less, called it completely brilliant. Started by asking Giles about where he started when he was putting the book together.
I suppose I started, personally, because the book does cover the age of Shakespeare to the modern day, but I began about 60 years ago when I was a small boy. The first Shakespeare play I think I went to see was Romeo and Juliet. It was the Old Vic in London. It was a famous production directed by Franco Zeffirelli, starring the young Judi Dench. I went with my parents. Judi Dench's parents were there. And I remember it vividly because Judi Dench ran onto the stage. She was playing Juliet. John Stride was playing Romeo. And the nurse was being played by an actress called Peggy Mount. And Judi Dench, this young girl, ran onto the stage wearing her white nightie. And she ran towards the nurse. And she spoke her opening line, which was, "Where are my mother and my father, nurse?" And from the third row of the stalls, a voice called out, "Here we are, darling, row C." Now, this really happened. And many years later, when I met Dame Judi Dench, I told her this story. And she said, it's absolutely true. It genuinely happened. I remember it vividly. What the book is about, it's a collection of extraordinary things that have happened in the theatre. And also some not so extraordinary things. The idea is to give a flavour of what theatre has been like. I got the idea for doing it at the beginning of the year because Judi Dench and I were due to do a show celebrating her life. We were due to open on the very day that lockdown last began. We had to cancel it. So I thought, well, she tells all these wonderful stories, and I do know a lot of theatre stories. Why don't I try and create a book that contains all the best theatre stories over 500 years, from the age of Shakespeare to the present day? Some are funny, some are sad. The idea is to really give you the essence of what live theatre is, because we're missing it at the moment.
And did you set yourself any rules when you were compiling these?
Rules were set for me by the Oxford University Press, who are the publishers. They had to be genuine stories. They said, we love hearing your funny stories, Giles, because I told them about how I'd been lucky enough to meet many of the great actors of, you know, the last generation, people like Sir Ralph Richardson, Sir Laurence Olivier, Sir Michael Redgrave, Sir John Gielgud. And I told them about how, when I was an MP in the 1990s, Sir John Gielgud had come to have lunch with me at the House of Commons. We were joined by Glenda Jackson, who was also an MP. We had lunch with Sir John Gielgud on his 90th birthday. And we said to him, oh, Sir John, we are so thrilled that you, the great classical actor of the 20th century, should choose to come and have luncheon with us on your 90th birthday. And he said, oh, my dears, I'm delighted. You see, all my real friends are dead. They said, that's quite amusing, Giles, but it's just your story. We want real stories. So when I was able to authenticate, for example, Sir Donald Sinden, he told me how when he was playing Hamlet, he'd gone to see an older member of the cast, an old actor who was playing the part of Polonius. Young Donald Sinden said to him, you know, I'm struggling with Hamlet. I don't know, for example, what the relationship is between Hamlet and Ophelia. How close are they? How intimate are they? It's quite opaque in the text. I mean, for example, are they lovers? Does Hamlet sleep with Ophelia? And the old actor replied, well, I don't know about the West End, laddie, but we always did on tour. Now, it's an amusing story, but I can authenticate it. I can tell you who said it to whom and when. And that's the point. So this is stories about all the greats, going back to Richard Burbage, through Sir Henry Irving, the first actor to be knighted, right up through people like Sir Donald Sinden, right up to our time, people like Benedict Cumberbatch, Mark Rylance, and of course, Judi Dench and co.
The theatrical world, well, it must be alive with anecdotes like this. Why is it? I mean, if you were to do a book of political anecdotes, would it be the same?
It would be different, and it wouldn't be the same. And having been both a politician and a bit of an actor, I can tell you the difference. And the difference is this. Actors are interested in the audience. Politicians are sometimes only interested in themselves. The actors care about the audience because it's a two-way street. And therefore, when an actor tells a story, it's like a little play. And actors like to tell a story, so they dress them up in theatrical terms. I learned lots of surprising stuff. For example, I was writing about the man called John Junius Booth, who was a drunken actor, notorious for drinking on stage. Famously, he would be heard calling out into the wings in mid-performance, what's the line? What's the line? More than once, he was heard calling into the wings, what's the play? What's the play? Well, his son was the Booth who assassinated President Abraham Lincoln. He had a brother called Edwin Booth, who was a famous Hamlet. And a few years after Lincoln had been shot by Booth, Edwin Booth was still touring his Hamlet, and he was leaving Pennsylvania at the railroad station, a very crowded platform, and a man fell off the platform onto the railway line, literally as the train was about to move. And Edwin Booth was leaning out of the window, and he managed to catch this man and rescue him, pulled him into the train, saved this man's life, and only later discovered that the man whose life he had saved was the only son of Abraham Lincoln. So the brother of the actor who shot Lincoln saved the life of Lincoln's only son. So it's got stories in it that aren't just funny stories about the theatre, but also are interesting stories about theatre people.
Oh gosh, that's made me feel all shivery. Yeah. By looking at these anecdotes, by reading them, can they also tell us something serious and historical about the theatre?
Yes, they can. I mean, thinking of the plague time we're currently in, there are accounts in the book of Samuel Pepys, who loved the theatre during the Great Plague of 1665. And the theatres, of course, were mostly closed. The longest period theatres have been closed in this country was during the government of Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell, during his Commonwealth, he virtually forbade people to smile, let alone laughed, didn't like jokes, and didn't like the theatre. And I think the theatre was then closed for 16 years. But when it opened again, it burst out laughing. And there was the great period of restoration comedy, maybe the greatest period of high comedy this country has ever known. So there will be laughter at the end of the tunnel, light at the end of the tunnel. And my idea with the book is that while you can't go to the theatre, curl up by the fire, read this book and get hundreds of little miniature plays.
And the Oxford Book of Theatrical Anecdotes by Giles Brandreth is published by OUP Oxford. We've been talking today to Lucy Bland about her book, Brown Babies, published by Manchester University Press. We're coming to the end of our time with you, Lucy, sadly, but just briefly, what can we learn today about the experiences of these children who underwent this terrible ordeal? Is there anything that we can take forward in today's practice?
Well, I think we can learn how important a sense of belonging is for people. And if people aren't made welcome in the country, that is going to be enormously harmful for them for the rest of their lives. And that's something we have to be very aware of. The knowledge of these children, and indeed of the Windrush people, which is, of course, a much bigger number, really should be there up front. That history is so important for us to know. It's really important to have these histories as part of our everyday history, really. I mean, rather than just the great successes, the battles, we have to know about the presence of Black people, how they're absolutely central to the history of Britain.
And what's next for you? What are you working on at the moment?
One or two things, I think. I've just been doing an exhibition, which I want to mention, which is an online exhibition at the Mix Museum. It's an exhibition of these so-called brown babies. And so if anyone wants to look at this, there's a lot of information there. There's a lot of photographs. There's some oral history. You go to www.mixmuseum.org.uk and go in there and scroll down. You can find the exhibition. So I'm carrying on with that. I want to actually do more for that because I thought it'd be very interesting to talk to the half siblings of these so-called brown babies about their experiences of these children being born, how they felt, and also the ones that they've now met in the States. That would be quite interesting. As for other projects, I'm possibly going to do something very different, which is about human-canine relations. A history of, it's not a history of dogs, it's a history of the role dogs have played in various points in history, but I'm not sure about that yet.
And a question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I've recently read a wonderful book called The Underground Railway. It's about a literal railway of helping slaves escape. There were all those mechanisms for their escape, which are really fascinating. It's a brilliant read, although it's horrendous. It's still enormously compelling. It's a long book, but it's a real page turner because it's so well written and you're completely drawn in. So I'd really recommend that.
Thank you, Lucy. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But a heads up that our next show, a featured guest is crime writer Alison Bruce. She's talking about her new novel, The Moment Before Impact. We'll hear from Ashley Meggett on his debut novel, Dark Chorus, and also about a collaboration between the poet Nancy Gaffield and musical group The Drift. All past episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 radio website, cambridge105.co.uk, and you can listen to all the back episodes by subscribing to wherever you get your podcasts, and if you do, please rank us. It's always good to get a rating. But your last choice of music now, Lucy, is A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. Why this one?
I love this. I mean, I love jazz anyway, but John Coltrane, he was born in 1926. As a young man, he was in the war. He was in the Navy. He didn't come to Britain, and he didn't actually write A Love Supreme till a bit later, to 1965. But it's just such a haunting, amazing piece. And it's 33 minutes long. So if we just had the first 2 or 3 minutes, that would be wonderful because it's a brilliant opening.